Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to be talking about something that so many people say, kind of am getting it, kind of don't know what it's all about, but boy, I've really been trying to get it. What is it? It is happiness. Tonight, my guest is Peter Spinogatti. His book is Explaining Unhappiness, Dissolving the Paradox, I Am Good, I Feel Good. So many say, what is happiness? Am I supposed to be just jolly every day? And man, my back really hurts. And, you know, if I don't do something about, you know, these headaches, I'm just going to go crazy. Or, man, if I got to go to that job one more time and listen to that crap, and you're expecting me to be happy? How can I be happy? Is this the place I'm in and this world is just spinning around me and it just royally sucks these days and that's the kind of life I'm living in? So today we're going to be talking about assessing where we are, thinking about, is this really how I want to exist, and do I have an option to change my mind? Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
My pleasure.
So Peter, don't you think sometimes people say, this roller coaster is almost like a nightmare, right?
Of course, yes.
What are your thoughts about that?
Well, first of all, you have to convince people that they make themselves unhappy. Now, virtually everyone believes to some degree they do. Otherwise, they wouldn't buy books, self-help books. They wouldn't engage in a counselor or anything like that. So on some level, we know we're doing it, but it doesn't seem quite altogether that we're choosing it. It seems like we're causing it, you know.
Right.
Let me give you a rather simple example to make my point. We're all familiar with the idea of, say, a sore loser and a good sport. Now, both of these people enter a contest, and they both lost. Now, the sore loser not only loses the contest, which means he didn't get what he wanted, the desire remained unsatisfied, but he also dubs himself a loser. He takes it personally. And what he means is, what that means, he has an ego in the stake at the outcome. Whereas the good sport does no such thing. He lost the contest. He recognizes that you can lose in any kind of contest, but he doesn't take it personally. Now, what I'm suggesting is this, that not getting what you want in and of itself never makes anybody unhappy. You have to personalize it. In other words, unless your ego has a stake in the outcome, you're not really unhappy. Now, most people are not aware of that, but you can see that simply not getting what you want doesn't make somebody unhappy. What makes them unhappy is that they use that as evidence for what they think is wrong with them, which is what they thought was true even before they entered the contest, if you follow my position.
Right. You know, sometimes I think people say, I want something, and they're going after it. And if it doesn't walk like a duck, quack like a duck, have spots like a duck, and have spots like the duck that I am thinking of in my head, they don't recognize it as an outcome. Do you know what I'm saying? They always want to put it in a different category, and they can never find, quote, happiness, because they're searching for something that is appearing in their head, yet they don't really can't conceive of it, don't acknowledge it when it might show up, and maybe not even acknowledge that it doesn't have to show up how it's supposed to in the picture. It may just show up as a feeling or an emotion or an event or something like that, and we don't even recognize it, so they go along their unhappy way like forever, right?
Yes, but you see, I mean, look, typically, I mean, if you know the literature, in other words, it's always been said that unsatisfied desire equals unhappiness. It's been around since the Greeks, you know. And so, but that really, that formulation is not correct. See, the reason why people get unhappy, to make the point again, is that they see it as, if I didn't get it, it says something about them. themselves, instead of recognizing that every choice is problematic. I mean, every choice is a probability estimate. And so if it doesn't pan out, all that's happened is, well, sometimes you don't get what you want. Most of the time we do. But they use that as evidence that there's something wrong with them. And they do that without knowing it. It's all unconscious. They think that if they get themselves unhappy, that somehow will motivate them to do better in the future, which is not true. They simply are not recognizing the fact that all choices are probability estimates and may not pay out. Most of the time, it pays off very well. But you see, since most people have – look, most people come to the situation already believing that there's something not quite right with them. I mean, it's almost a chronic state of self-apology, and that's normal. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody says almost boastfully, well, nobody's perfect, and they think that's making an innocuous statement. But that's not innocuous at all. They say that people have things to prove. And when things don't turn out, they say, see, that proves that there's something wrong with me. Now, if you don't do that, to repeat my earlier assertion, well, that means, well, you didn't get what you wanted, but that says nothing about you. It's just the way the world is.
And also the idea of perfection. I think there's always this place we have to get to.
Exactly.
Or otherwise, we have to be validated, or we have to feel like we're always less than, or that we can't own up, and I think it's probably almost been like a historical thing, because if you look at it over the decades, you know, after the wars and stuff, people wanted to have a house. They wanted to have a picket fence so it would, quote, look good. Then they had to get an education because it made them look smarter. And then they had to have more cars in the bank, you know, and all this other stuff. So really, it's all about our outward experience versus what the inward is really about. That argument, you know?
It's very well put. I'm not preaching some sort of asceticism where we deny the things of the world. I mean, there's no reason why you wouldn't want to live in a nicer house, become successful. And most books on self help you become more successful, help you to acquire things. Those things aren't bad. They're perfectly legitimate. But if you use them to prove that somehow you're okay, then that's a whole other question. Wanting something because it pleases you is one thing, but wanting something because it proves that you're a winner is something altogether different.
What are we really looking at when we want something? You know, is it that feeling in our gut? Is it the feeling of validity? Is it the idea that we want to feel something, you know, fill the hole kind of idea in my body kind of idea? Or I want more of this because it somehow makes me feel better or more superior. Some of these are some of the ideas that people will talk about.
Yes, exactly. Well, they say it's not what you want that matters, but why you want it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, wanting something because it pleases you. I mean, wanting the material pleasures of this world are perfectly legitimate. But as I say, most people, like some of the things you mentioned earlier, you know, because you want recognition. You want people to say that you're a winner. If you didn't believe that about yourself, well, then you would be involved in the world and you would get things that you want because it pleases you, but not because you're saying, you see, I'm a winner. I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a beautiful car, but most people use a beautiful car as a status symbol. This whole question of status is intimately involved with what I'm saying, right?
Right.
Where you live, how many bedrooms you have in your apartment, what kind of a car do you drive, what kind of people do you know, that sort of a thing. And it all comes out of a generally held belief that people are defective and they need things to prove they're not. And it never ends. Now, you may have noticed, for example, like all these attempts at making people happy, it goes under the general heading of self-improvement. You notice self-improvement, but never the solutions. You're never going to get there. The assumption is that you're always going to be defective.
Right.
And I'm saying it's like putting a bandage on a wound that never heals. So I have a much more ambitious project in mind. What I have in mind, I want to get rid of the wound altogether.
Yeah.
And that's why I spent my book, I spent 60,000 words trying to explain.
Right. You know, because if you're never ever in this moment, say, you know what, this is good. I'm good.
Yeah.
It's okay. Everything's all right.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you have dirty dishes in the sink. It doesn't matter if you haven't taken a shower today. It doesn't matter that your kids come home screaming. It doesn't matter, you know, whatever. It's just in this moment, I'm okay. And to recognize that that's separate from all of the other stuff that we create and call our life, then all that stuff is not our life. It's what we choose to interact with. Our life is what we are, yes?
Yes. I think what you're saying is, look, actually what I'm saying has been around for a long time. You're familiar maybe with Viktor Frankl, Dr. Viktor. He wrote a very important book. And he was in Auschwitz. I mentioned it in my book. And every day was uncertain. When he got up in the morning, he didn't know whether they were going to send him to the gas chamber or not. Now, what he did was he decided that he was going to help his fellow inmates. And one of his famous lines, he says, the last of human freedoms is to choose one's attitude in a given set of circumstances. Now, if you can live peacefully in a situation where you don't know if you're going to live or die every day, well, that proves that the human mind is capable of choosing one's attitude regardless of the situation. Now, if this is not altogether a new idea. I mean, we've heard things like the kingdom of God is within you, you know, look within you. Everybody knows since time out of memory that somehow one's attitude is critical. I mean, whatever happens, how you view things will make the difference. Now, we kind of know it, but we only kind of know it. I'm making the point that, no, that's exactly the truth. I'm not being Pollyanna about this, you know. I mean, whatever's going on, like what you mentioned earlier, the kids are screaming, okay, something has to be done. Okay, so what attitude should you take about that? Now, if, for example, you feel you're inept as a parent, well, that's one attitude. If you feel, for example, kids scream and that has to be handled and I can handle it, that's another statement. So it's not the event, but how that event is perceived.
Right.
You know, we talk about perception as reality. Well, that's true. In other words, what happens, happens, but how you perceive it, that's what you do.
You know, I always talk about at end of lifetime, people say, I want them to be at peace. And people go around and try to create that to happen. And it's sort of like, what are you doing? You know, you know, what you're doing is you're trying to create your acceptance of the situation versus trying to allow those people to have their own space, whatever that is, peace or not. It's sort of like,
you know,
it's we sometimes see it as, you know, I call it the fight of death, and like who's choosing to take it with them, you know?
Yes, I think a lot most people think that when you're on your deathbed that they want company. Well, some do and some don't. Sometimes people just want to be left alone.
Yeah.
You know, and somehow that's how they're going to get their inner peace. They just want absolute quiet, you know.
Yeah.
Like the one thing we have to recognize is that then there's an unassailable truth, you know, like attitude is everything, and you are in charge of your attitude.
Right. And also, too, you know, even saying that about deathbed is, you know, this whole thing of we want to give them a peaceful life, a peaceful ending at home. Man, heck, put me in the hospital and how much drugs can you pump into me? You know what I mean?
Yes.
Why do I want to stay home and be in total misery, dragging it out the unnatural way? Well, maybe I don't want to do that. You know?
Yes,
I'd much rather, like, unplug it, right?
Yeah, we respect what they think. We don't impose what we think, you know, that sort of a thing, you know.
Yeah. Can we talk for a second? We talk about, in your book, a chapter says, biochemistry, never a love potion. We talk about depression, anxiety, chemical structure. And, you know, so many times people say, I've had this one friend, and she said all the time, oh, this depression, you know, it's just that I don't know if I can go tomorrow. I'll have to see how my depression is tomorrow. And you know, and identity with it. I saw something the other day on Twitter, and it said the woman was arrested because she was stealing food, and she says my diabetes made me do it. My diabetes is making me steal.
Yes.
So, you know, I think this idea of outside of ourselves has control versus us.
Well, you see, I mean, the whole question of depression, I mean, look, there's something called clinical depression, and there may be a biochemical basis for that, you know. But when a person says they're depressed, let me suggest something to you, which seems obvious to me, but maybe not obvious to anybody. Could you be depressed unless you are disesteemed, unless you think badly of yourself, unless you put yourself down? Could you be depressed?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Right.
So really, it's really a psychological issue, isn't it? In other words, a person who's depressed is in a profound state of self-contempt.
They're also in a state of comparison and judgment. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
In other words, that the world is the merry-go-round and how the heck do I get on it when really, you know, what are you trying to do? Where are you trying to get that you aren't?
Yes, well, as I say, you see, but see, if the world is a merry-go-round, it always comes back to us, you know, how we're viewing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at the world and we say, okay, now, we're very impressed by people who are self-confident. But what is a self-confident person believing? A self-confident person believes that they're able to handle whatever's coming up.
Right.
We admire that. We love that. Now, people who need psychotherapy and whatever, these are people who don't believe that about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In other words, they're saying, wait a minute, I can handle this. I know what I'm doing. I mean, does such a person require any kind of psychological help? I don't think so. Now, how do you get that way? Well, we can talk about that. I mean, how does one say, whatever comes up, I can handle? That kind of a person is a very unusual person, but that's what we want to be. That's who we want to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so as I say, you can never escape that, you know. And in a sense, everybody kind of knows it, but kind of knowing it is not good enough. You have to know it.
Right, because it really, life has a lot of challenges in it. I mean, you can go out in your car and you're going to encounter another car. You're going to encounter a red light. You're going to encounter someone going
yes.
through the red light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, it's there. You know, a cold or a flu or illness or disease, it's there. It's not like we can walk through life and say, oh, no, I'm not going to engage in you because you're the big, bad, dark forces. You know, I'm going to be smiling and happy. And then that denial will kind of get you in the toilet, too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, as I say, there are always going to be obstacles. I mean, that's the nature of life, right?
Okay. Right.
You know, and we can control some of the things, but there's always going to be things that we hadn't anticipated, you know.
Right.
And anxiety comes about by saying, oh, I can't handle what I can't anticipate, but that's not true. I mean, if you say, okay, like I was talking to a client earlier today, and she had some fear of flying, you know, which is a very common kind of a thing, you know. All right, so now how do you overcome that? Well, what are they doing? They keep on looking down, and they play this game in their head, oh, my God, suppose the plane goes down. Now, statistically, the chances of a plane going down are very, very small, but this is not a statistical game. It's a psychological game. So
mm-hmm.
why do they do that? I mean, why do people make themselves afraid of things? It's really an interesting question, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. So why do they do that? So, I mean, you know perfectly well, of course a plane can go down. You know perfectly well the odds of that happening are very, very small. And yet you do that. So what happens, let me see if I can put it in kind of more everyday terms. In other words, people make themselves afraid because they think if they make themselves afraid of things, it will not happen. It's a very kind of primitive kind of thinking, but that's
mm-hmm.
what they do, right? In other words, they're afraid of being, they don't want to be caught unawares. So they make themselves afraid of this and they make themselves afraid of that because they believe that this will save them when in point of fact it doesn't.
Just as we see this a lot in healthcare, you know, with this vaccination stuff, you have to get them. Make sure you get them. How many did you get them? How many more are you going to get them, you know? Because it's going to prevent you from getting sick. And then when people get sick, they're like, you know, then we have the others who are saying, see, I told you, you know, on the other end. So it's kind of, it's really the herd effect, H-E-R-D, in healthcare and in many other types, I think, of life. And even social media is a real herd effect, you know.
Yes.
You follow it and you're good to go and, you know, bump out of that by, you know, like a little peg in the wheel. And, boy, someone's sure there to point it out to you, right?
Yes. Well, you know what, as I say, like these things come up, right? Okay.
Right.
In other words, and you know, for example, the social media, right? Well, that, maybe it's a separate question, but it's, social media has had its positive effects, obviously, but it has some negative effects. It's been now saying that the art of conversation is dying because people would much rather deal with their iPhone, for example, than talk to another human being. I mean, there's always a downside to these technological advances, right? You know, and so you see, for example, at a dinner table, you'll see a whole bunch of people, maybe five or six of them, looking at their phones. You know,
right.
And you know, say, well, I mean, it's a plus, but it's also a minus attached to it.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk for a second, Peter? In your book, you also talk about you have a few phrases in here, and these phrases I hear quite often. The other woman makes me.
Exactly.
Or cloudy days do this.
Exactly.
Or they, this happens when she doesn't, or,
yeah.
you know, and it's always something does something to you.
Yes.
Yes?
You know, see, you notice they're all stated in causally.
Mm-hmm.
Rainy days make me melancholy. She made me. You notice what people are saying. They say those things out there cause me to feel bad in here. But the truth of the matter is none of that's true. Because what should be said is I make myself unhappy with rainy days. Rainy days doesn't have the innate capacity to make you sad. It's something you're doing in reaction to that. So in other words, in all these passive statements, things happening, whatever is happening. For example, let's take this question of jealousy. Let's say, for example, a woman observes her husband talking to a very attractive woman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, and then a lady might complain and say, I got this gut reaction, a pain in my stomach, that informed her that she'd become jealous. Now, if you were to ask her, well, how did you become jealous? She would probably say, well, had my husband not been talking to this attractive woman, I would not have become jealous.
Right.
So in her mind, what happened out there caused her to become jealous. When in point of fact, what happened didn't cause her to become jealous. She made herself jealous. And the way here's what really went on in her head.
Mm-hmm.
With she's perceiving her husband talking to an attractive woman. That's really a very harmless event. But what she does is compare herself to this lady, and she sees this woman as maybe more vivacious, more intelligent, more something, and she sees herself as less than desirable. Now, the fact that she thinks herself as less than desirable allows her to perceive, and so she's using this woman as a point of comparison.
Right.
I mean, she's minding her business. She's just talking to her husband. But she compares herself to this other person and makes herself feel bad. But she mistakenly thinks that the mere act of her husband talking to an attractive woman caused her to feel bad. But actually, she made herself feel bad. She made herself feel bad because she brought to the situation a belief that she herself was less than desirable. So
right. It was already about her, and it was
exactly.
Right,
exactly.
She couldn't see that. And also, too, that also points out, you know, of her basis of trust of herself and her feelings, her basis of trust of someone else, but also, too, her idea that what's her defect, you know. Kind of like when those things rise up in people, they always want to blame it on someone else because the illusion or the story that you're telling yourself is like, am I going to create an illusion so that everybody will think I'm great and I can just keep my secrets and my story to myself, right?
Yes, but you notice that it all starts with her belief that she herself was less than desirable. If she didn't think that way about herself, it would be a non-event.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Now, this idea that we're less than desirable, I maintain, is universal. I mean, there are very few people out there who don't have some degree of self-doubt. I mean, practically everybody thinks, well, they're not attractive enough or intelligent enough or popular enough or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We learn that very early in life. I mean, if you look at a two-year-old, a two-year-old can look in a mirror, and they can observe themselves, but they never see anything that's unacceptable. Check back later when they get older, and they find out all things that are unacceptable about them. I mean, she'll think her nose is too big. He's going to think he's not popular enough. And so we learn to demean ourselves, and practically every culture in the world teaches their kids in one way or another that they're not altogether right. And then and then we go through life, and it's normal.
Mm-hmm.
Normal is not necessarily a good thing. You know, Abraham Maslow, a very important psychologist of the second half of the 20th century, said what is normal is the psychopathology of the average.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's got that right. In other words, I don't want to be normal. I want to be happy.
Right.
And, but what normal is, people say, well, you know, there's something wrong with you. You're not quite good enough. And you may have noticed, even people who presumably have all the advantages of the material life, people who are successful, people who are rich, how many of these people are on drugs and very unhappy?
You know, the idea of normal to me is almost like, I want you to resonate like me. I want you to be in the exact same place so that I won't feel that, you know, I'm abnormal. In other words, I want you to appear as validating the place I'm in, whatever that might be.
Yes. You know, well, yeah, as I say, so if everybody is not normal, if everybody is normal, it's normal.
Right.
And I'm saying I'm not interested in being normal. I'm interested in being happy. If normal means being unhappy, well, then I don't want to be normal.
You know, it's so funny. Yeah. At one time, it was probably, I guess, maybe about 30 years ago, someone had said to me, it was a doctor I was going on a medical rotation with, and as soon as he met me, I don't think it was 2 seconds after I said hello, he said, "What nationality are you?" And I said, "I was Irish and Polish." He says, "Oh, no wonder you look so plain." And I went, "What? What are you talking about?" You know what I mean? It was just such an oddity that I kind of remember it. It never affected me, but I remember it because it was like, oh, that was odd.
I know. It's amazing. You know, well, actually, I think you're touching on something maybe we should talk about, this question of political correctness, you know. I mean, people have certain stereotypes of people. Now, he has a stereotype that people who are Irish and Polish are plain. I mean, I never heard of such a stereotype. I mean, not at all. But the point I'm making is that, you know, so it's, in order to kind of remove yourself from all this kind of political correctness is when a person calls, let's say, had called you a name, instead of taking offense, you'd have to ask yourself, wait a minute, do I conform to that stereotype? Now, if you have some suspicion, like let's say somebody in the future said, you know, Dr. Gallagher, you're Irish, or you're plain because you're Irish and Polish, I should think you would laugh. What in the world are they talking about?
It was odd.
Yeah, and you remember it because it's so odd, you know. Uh-huh. But I come from an Italian background. When I was a kid, in those days, it was common for people to hear epithets like dago, wop, greaseball, that sort of thing. Nowadays, the demographics have changed considerably. You don't hear it too often. But when I was a kid, I thought I had to do something about that. But now, if I heard that nowadays, it would have absolutely no impact on me whatsoever.
Right.
Because you have a stereotype of what Italians are. I don't conform to that stereotype. And not only would I not feel bad, this person is revealing a great deal about themselves. They're not saying anything about me. They're revealing something about themselves. So this whole question of being called names or being stereotyped, I don't take offense at all.
You think that's where that judgment comes in, and that's really when it starts to tag along? Are you happy or not happy, or, you know, how you're living your life? It's just because of that tags. It's sort of like labels, you know, that we get.
Yeah, exactly. But if you don't agree to the label, then who can get to you? You know, the idea is simply somebody labels you. Oh, what if now the average person takes offense at that? You know,
right?
I mean, for example, Polish and Irish, I don't even know if such a stereotype exists, but in this man's head, he has some idea that you're supposed to look a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Well, okay, are we supposed to be responsible for his for his own stereotyping?
Right, for his, yeah, for
you know,
his own whatever.
I don't know where he's coming from. It has nothing to do with it, but you notice, for example, with this terrible political correctness stuff, I mean, people say, well, I take offense. And then acting as if that's a badge of distinction. I would say, why?
Yes,
why are you taking offense? The fact of the matter is they called you a name, they want you to feel bad, and then you proceed to accommodate them? Very peculiar, isn't it?
It gets this vicious cycle of then you have to get all of your peers and your peeps around you to be able to now cause, you know, we got to riot about it. We got to get out there. We got to make our mark. And it's like then now you're really in a resistance kind of dogma.
Yeah, I mean, why? The point is this: every human being is in possession of his own brain,
right?
And they have certain ideas as to they. It comes back to what we've been talking about. In other words, the source of all our feeling bad is because we believe we are bad. And if we stop believing that we are bad, we will now experience the world in a radically different way. We will be at peace. You know,
I think we're seeing this now with the evolution of a lot of religions shape-shifting and a lot of people going to more spirituality concepts and ideas, but still holding on to a religion kind of idea, but not holding all the religion principles. I mean, I'm a Roman Catholic, you know, grew up in the 50s. This is your catechism, this is what you recite, and that's the way it is. And don't forget, you're a real bad person because you came in with original sin anyway, and you'll never, ever be anything because you're always going to be less than. You know,
yes.
You go, wait a minute, what the heck would that come from, you know?
Well,
I mean,
as
you said in your book, Peter, you know, that people are not born bad. We're not born bad, you know?
No, we're not. And that's why I dispute that I was born a Catholic also. And the idea, for example, the word they used to use when I was a kid was concupiscence. Now, concupiscence means you have a natural inclination to evil. But right. I dispute that. In other words, if Jesus died for our sins, well, then believe him. He didn't say, die for your sins, but you got to watch it. You can't trust yourself. No. Mm-hmm. If he died for your sins, that means he's saying that you are a good human being. You're decent. You can mm-hmm. trust that. You can trust his judgment. But somehow, historically along the way, that they didn't translate it that way. You know, somehow, I don't believe I have a natural inclination to evil, nor do I believe you have a natural inclination to evil.
Mm-hmm.
But you see how important that is. In other words, for example, are you predisposed not to treat your neighbor decently? I'm not. You're not.
Yeah.
You know, but somehow people walk around and say, well, you know, I can't trust myself to do the right thing. And I'm saying, of course you can trust yourself to do the right thing. You're a decent human being. You're a child of God. You're good. I'm good. You're good.
Right.
Now, if we believed that all our lives, we would be very, very peaceful people, wouldn't we?
Yeah. You know, that brings us right around to the circle to the beginning of our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And in closing is that if you gather up a line of five people and you tell a story to the first one and you get to the end and you believe the end is the dogma, and it's totally different than in the beginning,
yes.
you know, but yet you're going to believe that which you've created and you've believed, which is totally different than anybody or anything else. In other words, we can all stand here and say the sky is blue, but I'll be darned if we all can pinpoint it all on the same spectrum of light. We couldn't.
No. Matter of fact, that experiment you talked about, I've even seen it done with different languages. It's even more outrageous.
Yeah.
It has
right.
the fifth storytelling has no relationship to the first at all. I mean, zero relationship, you know. Yeah, but
right.
you know, as I say, people interpret things in terms of their own lights. But if you're, I think a person who's at peace with themselves would probably give a more accurate narrative. No, they would say it more accurately. But people who have, you know, who have problems of their own, they tend to distort things or see things in ways that wasn't the truth at the first, in the beginning. You know what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying? You know,
right.
Yeah.
But also, too, the idea that, you know, if my knee hurts and I'm trying to tell someone and they're saying, oh, I know what I know what you're feeling. Baloney, you do not. My knee hurts. Can you
yes.
touch it? Do you feel it? Do you know what it is? So
yeah,
I think we're all individual to our own experience.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in my book, I mentioned, for example, how people who treat pain, you know. I mean, pain is very, very subjective thing. For example,
mm-hmm.
People, I mean, masochists, for example, love pain,
mm-hmm.
right? And so obviously they see pain differently. Anyway, pain, I think most people see pain as a form of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned that pain, the etymological derivation of the word pain is punishment, both in the
right.
Greek and the Latin. So when people talk about pain, they tend to see it as some form of punishment, which is not true. But
right.
if you simply see it as a biological reality and you're not being punished, well, not being punished makes a big difference as to how you experience it.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? So look, no matter how you shape it up, no matter how you do it, it always comes back to how you what your attitude is. Attitude
right.
is critical. Attitude is the name of the game, you know. As a matter of fact, you can say, when you talk about experience, it's virtually interchangeable with attitude, isn't it?
Right.
What is your experience of that? Well, what's your attitude about it? And your attitude is something that is always freely chosen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now people believe it to some extent, but I'm saying no, it's the whole ball of wax. You have
right.
to believe that how the world is filtered to how you see things, and how you see things is further filtered to how you see yourself. And if you're at peace with yourself, you're going to see the world quite differently.
Absolutely. Well, Peter, we've come to the end of our time today. Can you share with the listeners how to find out more information about you?
Yes. Well, my book is called Explaining Unhappiness, and it can be what our universe, Amazon, that sort of a thing. And also, it gives a more detailed, rigorous explanation as to what we've been talking about. Now, if sometimes people want to talk to me personally. I'm available for personal and group coaching. Sometimes they want to get a hold of me. I can talk to them on that basis.
Well, Peter, I think it's really great that we talked about unhappiness because, you know what, so many times guests want to come on and they're like, this is happy, and they deny that the experience is out there. We need to talk about the words that people are using right now, and
yes,
that
indeed.
Was really
yes.
a great time to do that.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Dr. Gallagher. I really
oh,
appreciate it.
I really thank you for coming on. Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you. If you'd like to find out more information about Peter, again, his book is Explaining Unhappiness, Dissolving the Paradox, I Am Good, I Feel Good. His name is Peter Spinogatti, and the link is on the bottom of today's show page. Click on it. You go directly to his website. And
okay.
Really, it's about being able to experience the world around you. And as Peter has shared with us, you do have a choice. So thank you so much for joining us today. Until tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.